series of crises in this language of construction, then, is reflective of a crisis in naming, articulating, coding, knowing, or mapping. The female subject complicates this crisis, both as an object which sits outside of this project of construction, and a subject which is termed or terms itself as such a subject. While the use of the word subject is always indicative of a problematic construction, it will be used today as a marker for and of discourses and surfaces which author selves or identities, writing subjects which come to stand for and as narrative surfaces in 20th century discourse. Okay, so that's your introduction to the way that we're thinking about this. So I will begin this panel's discussion with a look at the revisioning, literally that split up, so it's re-seeing, revisioning, and rewriting, revisioning, think of it in both of those ways, of Marilyn Monroe, a subject who figures for more figuring than most, a three-dimensional figure, a figure of whom Billy Travilla, one of her dressmakers, claimed to know the true dimensions, the real figures, a subject who once requested that her tombstone simply bear the figures of her true form, 35, 24, 35. We can't say that this is a subject who evidences no irony in her construction. A construction in which she participated actively in her life, coining phrases which became known as Monroeisms, revisioning her history again and again for reporters, potential biographers, photographers. They all figured into her constructions. Of course, we can go back and revision her story. We may say that she didn't really want to dye her hair, as did Steinem, and that this points to an essentialist and possibly feminist identification which obscures her status as sex symbol. The battle is won of figurings. Whose symbol will she be? Gloria Steinem appropriates or liberates for women what Norman Mailer penetrates or consecrates for the American man. Icons of figuring figure the iconic figure. If this isn't ironic, maybe, then what is? Okay. I'm working on a longer project, which is my dissertation, on Marilyn Monroe, and looking at her both as a surface for history telling history, okay, and mythification of the American subject, American subjectivity, okay. But today I'm just talking about one area of that project or projection. This is the Marilyn Monroe of the post-mortem era. The Marilyn Monroe washed ashore in a sea of words who asks only to be read and read well. In her life, Steinem tells us, she begged others to take her seriously, admonishing photobiographer Barris, please don't make me a joke. And now she services as a narrative which seems to multiply itself as versions and revisionings of the American historical sensibility, the writing of our history's biography, in the form and figure of Marilyn, the suicide gone homicide gone suicide again. The goddess turned corpse, evidenced in and on her deathbed. The readings of her dead body equal the constant process of exhumation which so closely parallels what counts as writing history in the society. She's the icon for remembrance, for the new Madonna, for the historical coroner, waxing poetic about her fate, her form, her figure. So let us turn to case number 81128, which is her coroner case number, and Thomas Noguchi's bestseller, Coroner to the Stars. Coroners, perhaps. Yes. The most obvious manifestation of the history as exhumation, history as exhumation, discourse, which is increasingly prevalent in our mass culture. In a society in which knowledge has come to equal evidence, managed by experts, this evidence is manipulated and produced, discovered and made public through the detective-like workings of an information systems philosophy. Our faith in the pervasiveness of the factual leads us to believe that we have only to uncover the evidence for the truth to be told. So we turn incessantly to our technologies or technical knowledges for reproducing and representing realities. Records of phone bills, autopsies, chemical analyses, newsreels. You can think here of the role the Zapruder film played in the attempts to reconstruct JFK's death and the inner workings of its mechanisms for replication and reproduction. We hope to find the shadow, literally, which would tell the truth as the story never seemed to. We have faith that our technologies of recording will set the record straight. They will tell us just how drunk someone is, whether or not someone is lying, or if they have or carry an HIV virus. You know, those are just some, so it's AIDS, of course. We believe that the right information will lead us to the right conclusions when summing up or figuring a subject. Information systems philosophy. This is the case with the construction taking place on, as, and around the life slash death or form of Marilyn Monroe. Increasingly, most biographical representations spend more time on details of her death than on her life. This was the case with Summer's book, Goddess, The Secret Lives of Marilyn Monroe, which virtually skipped her childhood, which he explained by saying everybody knows about her childhood, and spent several chapters on the details of her last hours, her autopsy, and you know, her burial, I mean, all of the details of her death. Noguchi's book, Coroner, does the job one better by writing a series of narrative surfaces which equal the stories of the autopsies of famous American figures. For example, Sharon Tate, Natalie Wood, Bobby Kennedy, and he was the coroner to all these famous people. These are interspersed with the story of Noguchi's life, his anecdotes about the American and Japanese cultures, and his detailings of his subjects' lives. In the case of 81128, most of these details are either entirely wrong or significantly altered. He states, for example, that at the time of her death, Marilyn Monroe was living in a cheap rented home because she couldn't afford the rent in her expensive bungalow. Actually, she was living in the first home she'd ever owned. You know, things like this, but he just entirely rewrites her life. What's important here is not just a general faulting of Noguchi as historian, or he didn't check her list of sources, that kind of thing, but the translation of the subject, which is beginning to occur via his historical process. He will relate stories and impressions of Monroe's life as he details the state of her lymphatic system, the amount of Nimbutol in her stomach, the condition of her liver, according to toxicologist Ralph Abernethy. What is important is that he authorizes his deconstructive reconstruction on the basis of some mythical unnamed source of evidence or knowledge of his subject's life. He creates himself as authority because of his factual relationship to the actual Marilyn Monroe, her corpse. At the same time, he's creating a history made up of bits and pieces of images which haunt his subjectivity and encourage his revisioning of the corpse. She will be revealed to the reader as a sum of her bodily parts, the pieces of her mythical past, the content and color of her disorganized organs. Noguchi writes as he literally dissects the subject. Unembalmed blood is taken for alcohol and barbiturate examination. Liver, kidney, stomach and contents, urine and intestine are saved for further toxicological study. This sort of listing of Marilyn's body parts and the status of her bodily fluids is combined with writings such as his initial descriptions of his encounter with Marilyn Monroe as corpse. My mind wandered back to 1962, when I, a young and impressionable medical examiner, first viewed the body of Marilyn Monroe. Later I would be asked, how did she appear in death? And I could only reply with the words from the Latin poet Petrarch, it's folly to shrink in fear if this is dying, for death looked lovely in her lovely face. For his comments on her life, such as, the war saved her, after which he goes on to relate actual events in her life, but each is out of sequence and made to bear some moral judgment on sort of the status of America by Noguchi. It is as if the coroner now has absolute authority over the subject's life. It is he who will author her as he dissects her, because only he really knew her. After all, he was her coroner. While this is the most blatant example of this sort of revisioning and dissection which occurs around and as the writing the life of Marilyn Monroe, similar post-mortem fascinations may be evidenced in work as varied as Norman Mailer's and Anthony Summers. Excuse me. A recent Phil Donahue show was devoted to the topic of Monroe and spent a good deal of this time defining and speculating the cause of her death, circumstances of death, that kind of thing. In most of these cases, what was a suicide once is made now into a conspiracy at best and a homicide at worst. Each of these rewritings makes Monroe less powerful over her death and more of a surface to be written and won in the battle of figuring and fixing American identities and moments. We will now know Kennedy through Monroe, understand women's condition through and as that of Marilyn, as this time, even place her next to Rock Hudson on the People magazine cover as one in a series of problematic deaths or diseases dying to be resolved or resolved in the American not-so-unconscious mind. It is no accident that these revisionings occur under the banner of the times we've come to call postmodern. Marilyn seems to sue collage naturally, as she is so easily made into fragments and bits of speeches, clips from films, part of a body. She is all women and no woman, all excess in the blank slate. And so as we engage in a battle to remake her, we attempt to construct a subject which seems to express and relate the very problems of its own construction. This is especially true with suicides, who have created a particularly interesting and difficult surface by authoring a death which asks to be read as conscious and therefore possibly meaningful because it's authored. Okay. To reclaim the death of a suicide as a homicide is to rewrite a life story gone wrong, to make a victim of the suicide and a villain of the murderer. To rewrite the suicide as a conspiracy is to relocate meaning within the realm of the living, to lay blame on institutions or persons who exist apart from the suicide and to hold them responsible for writing a coherent script. Motive and reason then emerge as byproducts of this reconstruction. They make the death readable by writing it in terms we recognize as coherent and sensible. A logic of death is replaced here by a logic of life, a logic of the political, a logic of the historical, a logic which presents itself as forthright and readable. This is the logic applied to the life and death of Marilyn Monroe. The constant search for meaning in her death, the story behind her suicide, is waged so as to dispel the power of a frighteningly unreadable form. But this dispelling literally unspelling and dispelling, is never grounded in a single or simple resolution and rewriting. One deconstruction leads to a series of reconstructions and more deconstructions. There is no longer one true death, even as she didn't live one actual life. There are all these different kinds of lives that she was. Pardon? Oh, slow down, sorry. I'll try to not go over my time. What we are surrounded by are the writings and erasures of mythification, the vision of the American self or subject in postmodern America. Each writing tells us more about its author than its subject, reveals more of our time, our obsessions, our ideologies, our struggles, our attempts to make meaning stick. The Maryland Renaissance of the past few years is further indication of the ongoing nature of this crisis in constructing the female subject. Maryland has been rewritten and repaired to express and embody myths and signs as diverse as a feminist heroine role model in Steinem and a foil to the Kennedys' all-American identity, for example, in Summers. Norman Mailer has written her for and as his daughter in an Actors Studio performance of Straw Hat, in which he literally wrote a play about Monroe and had his daughter play Monroe. And he's also, as you know, probably written two books on Monroe, one in first person as if he were Monroe. Okay. That's a woman in their elegance. She is made to conform to the shapes required by the designs of her authors. She's transformed into Budweiser ads or movie posters. It's new movie Pretty Kill. I don't know if you've seen that they take the icon of the nude Marilyn from the beer calendar, and she's a hooker, an angel, a prostitute, sleep with her and you die. And last night in Times Square, I saw they have a huge Maxell tape billboard, which is reflected sort of grotesquely distorted in all of the, you know, windows and things around, and it says, Maxell, the legend, oh no, the tape that lasts as long as the legend, and a huge picture of Monroe. That's right. As she is made to extend everywhere, she's lost as a human subject and born as either a sign or a surface, a figure or an icon. As Marilyn Monroe replicates, she becomes a simulacrum, which is a copy with no originals, which is most like itself when located and translated into surfaces and spaces, perennially somewhere other than where the authentic or original self lives. And that's where I'm going to stop. I could go on, but I want to make sure that I'm looking to go. Thank you. Thank you.
Interestingly, my paper is also about a movie star. What I want to talk about is kind of the pre-postmodern moment that Frances fits into what Paige has talked about. And my title is called, as it says on the board, The Snake Pit of Postmodern Memory, Frances Farmer as the Hysterical Sublime. My femininity was mauled. My power to reason, simply, I've got the quote wrong. My femininity was mauled. My power to reason or struggle vanished. I simply existed in chilling confusion. This is a quote taken from this autobiography by Frances Farmer, when she has been in hydrotherapy for over 24 hours. Frances Farmer, movie star of the 1930s and 40s, a surface, a body, and a mind functioning today as a zone for interpretation of a certain historical shift, a place to map a history that is of hysteria, not in terms of her own diagnostic history so much as of an historical epistemological paradigm wherein bodies react and are acted upon, are used in terms of hysterical cultural visions as well as the historical legacy of the hysterical body. Quote, hysteria in particular has adapted its symptoms to the ideas and mores current in each society, yet its predispositions and its basic features have remained more or less unchanged, unquote. That comes from the book by Ilse Weitz called The History of Hysteria. Hysteria, then, can be a clinical diagnosis, a popular adjective for certain behavior, as well as a construction of a form of knowledge developed out of ideas of femininity, social norm, and the relation of the body to social, historical, political, and ideological meanings. It can also be a way of characterizing a form of dominant masculinist discourse at moments of crisis when it seeks to control, contain, undermine various deviants, adopting the language of medicine and sexuality as a form of social control. I am particularly interested in this paper in the relationship between bodies and knowledge, between gender and epistemology, between the embodiment of knowledge by historical subjects and the way historical subjects react to knowledge through their bodies. Hysteria has particular significance in this regard because it ranges over all of these areas. What I would like to do today is to just suggest some of the many ways that hysteria and history interact metaphorically and actually, using just a piece from the Francis Farmer story as symptomatic of a prefiguring of the postmodern crisis in knowledge, subjectivity, and a crisis in historicity, as it is related to gender and sexuality of the individual and the social body. I quote again. This is from a psychological monograph called Hysteria, the Elusive Neurosis. When considered, and so this is a scientific book. When considered within a particular culture, the definition of hysteria remains elusive because the definition itself rests largely on the way in which the disorder uses cultural forms, regardless of the culture-specific content of those forms. The hysteric uses the dominant forms of his culture in a particular way in an attempt to resolve conflict. End of quote. The use of dominant forms, the embodiment of a historical context, history and hysteria, a trope that turns both ways. For there is history in hysteria, a reaction to dominant forms, to personal histories, as well as hysteria in history. In other words, the period that I'm covering, the post-war, pre-war, World War II period, is also the period prefiguring the hysteria of anti-communism. Figurations of embodied knowledge, hysteria becomes a way into history. By looking at iconic moments where mind and body interface with each other, rupturing the boundaries of both simultaneously, precisely what both hysteria as an illness and cinema as a phenomena perform, one can read the reaction formations embedded in these figurations as struggles, as representations of bodily epistemological shifts, somatic interpretations against the grain of specific contexts. Part one, the history of hysteria. This is quite short, and Susan will pick up much more on some of this that I'm just going to suggest. An outbreak, an epidemic of sorts, erupting at the end of the 19th century among a certain class, middle, in a certain milieu, Europe and America, within a certain race, white, out of certain bodies, women's, figures a certain moment through its disease. A moment when certain bodies, writhing in articulate pain, are seen, in feminist hindsight, as flailing their embodied range, anxiety, powerlessness at the masters and makers of the condition of the historical moment they are in. But instead of asking if rebellion was mental pathology, we must ask whether mental pathology was suppressed rebellion, says Elaine Showalter in her book, The Female Malady. So emerges hysteria, not so much as a new disorder, but as a prevailing social fact marking the latter half of the 19th century as the golden age of this illness. The 20th century inherits this 19th century legacy through the literatures and new experimental languages of Wolfe and Gilman, at what Susan will be addressing, as well as in representations frozen in Charcot's documentation of the hysteric posing before his camera. Or scientifically, we receive the hysteric as and at the origin of psychoanalysis, where Bertha Pappenheim, celebrated activist, feminist, and writer during her time, appears in her starring role as Anna O, a character in Studies on Hysteria, a book fused with the musings of science and imagination. Charcot's and Freud's histories of hysteria are, it is true, of a very real illness, experienced in very real ways, hence my invocation of Wolfe and Gilman, who both experienced hysteria and wrote out of it.
Louder than the
But this story has been all too easily aligned with women made out of their femininity, seen as an illness which is a consequence of biology. The womb's misdirection up or down was for centuries seen as the cause of this illness, and it is the origin of its name. Hysteria, both a reaction to men and of men, at once an actual disorder, slides into the filters of the popular and scientific imagination of the 20th century. Quote, what has resulted in the case of the hysterical personality is a picture of women in the words of men. And as a perusal of these traits will show, what the description sounds like amounts to a caricature of femininity, exclamation point, end of quote. This is not a startling articulation, except that it is made by two prominent medical men in an article published in 1958 in the American Journal of Psychiatry. I wish to invoke the 19th century hysteric momentarily, not as a caricature nor merely a representation, but as a reminder, a reminiscence to be remembered, the signifier of a lived reality embedded in the social memory of the 20th century. Part two, the hysteric as history, history as hysteric. Hysterics suffer mainly from reminiscences Freud and Breuer tell us in their introduction to studies on hysteria. As this quote suggests, bodies overwhelmed by memories buried deep, carrying pains and associations so untenable they are masked, layered, converted into symptoms, subjects made ill by the force of the past, the hysteric is an historical text, where the past erupts into the present as a symptom which must be read. Traumas are uncovered slowly as the process of the investigating doctor, detective, archivist unpuzzles the palimpsests, sifting through the various texts, documents, symptoms, collecting them into a cure of insight, interpretation, and knowledge. In a recent paper delivered at the University of California at Santa Cruz called Make Believe, Male Subjectivity, Hollywood, and World War II, Kasia Silverman transforms the very notion of history itself into an hysterical formulation, much like the hysterics riddled with history described above. Taking off from Frederick Jameson's formulation that history is what hurts, she states more imperatively that history is trauma. It is, quote, a force capable of tearing a hole in the dominant fiction, unquote. And she's using dominant fiction to equal ideology at this moment. History as trauma, as rupture, tears into the seams and fabrics of culture, threatening signification. As the individual hysteric is seen to be subject to the riddles of an historical moment, so history reacts in a hysterical manner, forcing the trauma into a conversion, a signification which is controllable. She is concerned with the representation of male subjectivity in post-war Hollywood movies. She sees in such films as Pride of the Marines, The Best Years of Our Lives, It's a Wonderful Life, a form of coping with the trauma of the return of a ravaged, fragmented, ill, and shell-shocked male within these representations. Shell shock is the first moment when men were seen to be hysterical. It's called a form of male hysteria. Signification systems are produced which render the trauma of history into controllable images. The social body has become an hysterical body, suffering from its own reminiscences, burying the traumas of social upheaval, tension, rifts of the dominant fiction into fictions shimmering across screens, which project outwardly the contradictions and anxieties of social sexual identity in relation to the trauma of historical process. The notion of history as trauma obviously suggests hysteria, as I have intimated, but just as significant is the history Silverman has chosen to focus on, cinematic representations of the late 40s in relation to the post-war male subjectivity. It is at this time, from 1945 to 1950, that Frances Farmer is incarcerated in the state mental hospital Steilacoome in Seattle, Washington, and she's placed in the violent ward. Fittingly enough, in her description of what is known as the women's film, Marianne Doan makes the following statement. The women's films were films made for a female audience at this exact time, and she describes them as, quote, there is an almost obsessive association of the female protagonist with a deviation from some norm of mental stability or health, resulting in the recurrent investigation of psychical mechanisms frequently linked with the feminine condition, masochism, hysteria, neurosis, and paranoia. End of quote. While Silverman evokes a social moment where history read as trauma infiltrates the psyche of a post-war male subjectivity, and Doan uncovers a representational schema, a discursive community of and for women, which images the instability of their subjectivity within the familiar paradigm of pathology, Frances Farmer, no mere phantasm or disembodied subject, but renegade star fallen from the graces of the Hollywood dream machine, exists, as I quoted in the beginning of this paper, in chilling confusion. Part three, the realities of fantasy, the snake pit, and Frances Farmer. In 1945, Anatoly Litvak, an army colonel, was allowed to read the galleys of Mary Jane Ward's novel, The Snake Pit, from which he would eventually make a film of the same title, one characterized incidentally in Doan's description of the women's film. He described his interest in the film as wanting to, quote, awaken public interest in the vital matter to reassure people that mental disorder is an illness which can be cured, and to direct attention to facilities now available in our institutions, end of quote. In 1945, Frances Farmer was committed to Steilacoome by her mother. She already had a previous record, a social memory of sorts, of institutionalization in a Hollywood hospital, ostensibly for a drunk driving charge, but in reality due to her hysterical and offensive behavior in front of the police authorities, where she exhibited outright contempt and disregard for Hollywood and any vestige of an image of femininity which was socially acceptable at the time. This memory of a previous offense, as well as her continued rage against Hollywood, traditional institutions such as marriage and femininity, she drank, smoked, used foul language, was a loner, was described as dressing sloppily, made it quite easy for her mother to commit her in 1945, the year the conceptualization of the film The Snake Pit took place. In 1948, The Snake Pit was released, hailed as a revelation on mental health. Now, I have a long quote here that I'm actually not going to read, but what it's from this biography by William Arnold called Shadowland, and he describes this year of 1948, and he talks about how at that moment there were such, the institutions were so overcrowded, they started to use electric shock and lobotomy as ways of sort of trying to make more passive the members in the institution. And then he talks about how the place where Frances Farmer was, they brought in Dr. Freeman, who lobotomized her and lobotomized many of the women. And in the description, the lobotomy room is described as an operating theater, which, for people who are familiar with the history of hysteria in France, Charcot, the doctor who sort of brought hysteria out in a way, used to situate women in a kind of theater too. So, Frances Farmer, post-lobotomy, is an actress now who will no longer suffer from reminiscences. Note how the room where the lobotomy is performed is described as an operating theater, packed with many different kinds of spectators. From hypnosis to lobotomy, an infiltration and ravagement of a female imagination may be traced. This is a quote by Dr. Freeman describing what he sees lobotomy as, why, what it does, basically. Quote, the patients for whom this operation brings the best results are those who are tortured with self-concern, who suffer from terribly painful, disabling self-consciousness. Whether it expresses itself in pains of the body organs or terrible distress from feelings of persecution, in ordinary language, the technique severs the nerves that deliver emotional power to ideas. Along with a cure comes some loss in the patient's imaginative power. But that's what we want to do. They are sick in their imaginations. End of quote. Frances Farmer, terrible icon of rebellious femininity, represents a sickness, a trauma, to the social imaginings of a time. Yet it is her imagination and the likes of ones regarded as similarly deviant at the time, political subversives, communists, homosexuals, which is seen as sick. As the emotional affect of her mind is being severed, as its imagination is cured of its power, Hollywood produces an imagining, The Snake Pit, a filmic representation, a surface to protect and bury the wound which replaces, consumes, becomes an icon of this age's historical memory. The historical coincidence of the release of The Snake Pit, celebrated at the time for depicting insanity with terrifying precision, as well as for doing, quote, what Hollywood had rarely done before, look harsh reality in the time, unquote, with the literal, actual derealization of the imagination of one of Hollywood's once upon a time icons of movie star femininity, resonates horrifically with a glance at the credits of the film. Playing a minor but significant role as a psychiatrist in the latter part of the film is Leif Erikson, who had been Frances Farmer's husband in the 30s when she was in Hollywood. He plays the overseer of the violent ward where Virginia, played by Olivia de Havilland, is sent after a breakdown. At this very moment, Erickson's ex-wife is in an actual violent ward. A social memory, incapable of repressing the trauma of Farmer's absence from memory at this moment in time, forces the appearance of Erickson as a kind of uncanny symptom, a layer of association figuring in muted, unrecognized, macabre unreality, the wound of the confined and lobotomized rebellious wife. I say this because I've never heard anybody mention that Erickson is in this film or playing this role. I do not draw the connection between Erickson and Farmer for nostalgia, romance, or even in order to ask whether he, like the other stars in the film, researched his part in order to achieve the clinical accuracy for which, in the case of de Havilland, the film was acclaimed. No, their marriage was long over. It was apparently a creation of the climate of idealized Hollywood heterosexuality rather than any bond between the lovers at the time. But the connection is a fundamental one, since it is the inability of Farmer to adapt to the kind of social conformity that marriage represents, which was seen as a sign of her strangeness. Marriage as a sign of cure is also the moral of The Snake Pit. As Leslie Fishbein has said, the film, quote, celebrates the efficacy of psychoanalysis in restoring its heroine to mental health. A cure which transforms Virginia from the psychotic who rejects her husband, who cannot recognize him at the beginning of the film, into the responsible, knowing wife at the end. As Fishbein continues, he says, thus, while The Snake Pit won public acclaim for its realistic treatment of the theme of mental illness, its more central concern was the crisis in modern womanhood, which popularized Freudianism had promised to solve by its parallel of femininity and mental health, unquote. Significantly, in the beginning of the film, when Virginia sees the hospital as a prison and Dr. Kick as a warden, these social criticisms are seen as the ravings of a madwoman. It is here that the residues of a rebellious femininity, read as deranged as the rantings of a woman with no organic ills, for there's no reasons for her ramblings, are muted, read as the products of a sick imagination. Farmer's disdain for Hollywood as an institution was also seen to be the ravings of someone, quote, hopelessly insane, unquote. In this sense, like the hysteric in the depiction quoted earlier, it is the cultural dominant of the historical moment which Farmer rebels against, specifically the image or plot space of femininity, which is the sign of mental health in the snake pit. It is important to remember that hysteria is an actual manifestation of frustrations, angers, traumas, enacted through bodies at war with the demands of their genders and the demands of sexual conventions. It is a disorder emerging out of ambivalence, as well as reflecting an ambivalence of patriarchy with non-conventional sexuality desires and expressions. The 19th century hysteric is seen to be reacting to the silencing of her period, to a reality which offers no figuration for the legitimate pursuit of an intellectual, creative, productive life. And so the body bursts forth with tortured meanings, as does her language, muted, torn, experimental, representing the desperation to contest and remake the masculine discourse of the time. There is no revolution in hysteria, as there was no revolution for Farmer, but it does figure the dilemmas of the rejection of femininity, and therefore it must be read with seriousness. For Farmer has now been reclaimed as synonymous with a feminine rage at Hollywood.
I think there's even another film about it.
A depthless surface shimmering into the dispersions of the postmodern cultural dominant, Farmer herself, lobotomized, removed of her emotional affect, exists as the chilling confusion of this hysterical sublime, embodying for us the crisis in history, the trauma of the loss of reminiscences, which characterize, according to Jameson, the very condition of the postmodern. Work has been important to me in thinking through what I've done here in this paper. And I also want to warn you and comment on the fragmentary condition of this paper, which is deliberate, but there are going to be times when I pause and go on to something that may seem unrelated, but is related just in not maybe an immediately obvious way. I hope the reason for that will become clear. And also, these are examples of what I'm talking about in the paper, and I've blown them up like this because to emphasize the way in which their visual arrangement on the page is as important as the content that they're trying to convey, and that they have been arranged in this way very deliberately. I mean, it's been suggested by some women poets working in this tradition that their work should be displayed like a show in a gallery rather than read in a book. So this is my display of it. Okay, Page and Thirza have focused on a postmodern moment and a modernist turning postmodern moment in constructions and representations of women. And I want to turn now to some of the fictions modernist women have constructed themselves and the ways in which the poetics informing these constructions have been inherited and transformed by some contemporary women writers, especially poets. Early 20th century British and American women writers inherited the predominantly white and middle class 19th century debate around the woman question.
With a large increase of women writing in the 19th century, one of the main issues around which the woman question debate revolved was women's proper relation to writing and literature. These discussions focused on the links between sexuality and art. And I quote, "In mid-19th century discussions of women in literature, the sexually laden language suggests two theories. According to one, female imagination is a volatile and highly erotic force that must be repressed or at least controlled. According to the other, women's writing is a sign of sexual and emotional frustration. Both must be seen against the prevailing assumption that artistic creation is, like the sexual act, a male activity in which women have only an extremely restricted part." As the Saturday Review reminds readers in 1865, female nature, mental as well as physical, is essentially receptive and not creative. From the mid to late Victorian period, there was a remarkable increase of madness, of institutionalization, and of publication among women. At this time and on into the early 20th century, the contradictory demands and expectations on women to be, in the midst of an increasingly industrialized society, representatives of feminine purity and order, and to be perfectly controlled in their conduct and skilled in domestic managerial capacities, coincided with a growing fear of female sexuality. In reading the fiction and poetry written by many modernist women with Freud's late Victorian analyses of female hysterics, it is striking to see what could be called a poetics of hysteria emerge. For hysterics, this was a grammar of subversion spoken through the body and in words, as Thirza has described, but not written, at least not by Freud's hysterics, although perhaps by Freud himself. For the women writers, it is a subversion of grammar and other given rules of ordering words on the page. This refusal to follow received rules of composition also had the impact of producing bodies of writing that were diagnosed by male critics or writer authorities as abnormal, unhealthy in a peculiarly feminine way. As Thirza and others have suggested, hysteria can be viewed as an expression of the desire to escape the strangulating demands of repressive, patriarchal, bourgeois family and social expectations. The classic symptoms of hysteria, loss of voice, loss of the use of a limb, complete muteness, stammering, coughs, loss or disorder of memory, hallucinations, nightmares and hostility, fragmentation of logical trains of thought, can all be seen as attempts to break out of social roles by exaggerated identification with what was considered feminine, or through exploration of alternate modes of experiencing and describing the world. The symptoms shared by poems and novels that were healthy and made sense, like hysterics when recovered and normal, was that they both were able to tell linear narratives proceeding along logical sequences of thought, rather than falling in their telling through a steep kilter of association, fragmentation, mute spaces on the page, palimpsestic memory overlays, hostile harangues, or hallucinatory lapses. Freud wrote four instead of his hysterics and was himself disturbed by the mode in which he wrote up these case histories. And this is Freud. "It still strikes me myself as strange that the case histories I write should read like short stories, and that, as one might say, they lack the serious stamp of science. I must console myself with the reflection that the nature of the subject, that is women, hysterical women, is evidently responsible for this, rather than any preference of my own. The fact is that local diagnosis and electrical reactions lead nowhere in the study of hysteria, whereas a detailed description of mental processes such as we are accustomed to find in the works of imaginative writers enables me, with the use of a few psychological formulas, to obtain at least some kind of insight into the course of that affection." And as Bernheimer says of Freud, "The sheer complication of the processes to be represented at the meta level forces Freud to resort to a language of similes. So science, in this matter of psychology, often speaks in the figures of poetry. And since such figuration, as Freud noted in 1897, has much in common with hysterical fantasies, one might argue that Freud's ambivalence about the literary aspect of his work reflects his uneasy awareness of his own hysterical potential. And as Freud himself said, the mechanism of poetry is the same as that of hysterical fantasies. It is a terrible thing for a man to be forced to resort to a language of similes." And this is from Norman O'Brown. It is, but reorganized by me. It is terrible for a girl to be a wall. I am that tree. That's the rain. I could be the rain, that chair, that wall. Every raving girl is a Delphic priestess or a Daphne saying, I am that. It is a terrifying thing for a girl to be chased and turned into a laurel. More terrible still when she who is Daphne is poetry begins to write. I do not wish to imply that modernist or contemporary experimentalist women writers are hysterics. Instead, I want to call attention to this coincidence in representations that is no accident. Hysterics, women writers, Freud, all attempt to articulate something that is socially rampant at their historical moment. Hysterical symptoms existed and continue to exist, but as in current discussions of AIDS, it is the moral overtones in these debates that manifest widespread social anxiety about sexuality and morality in the early century and now. How to take behavior and communication coded deviant as sources that offer possible forms for a different coherence, or as precedent for a comprehensible kind of incoherence? How does this get translated into writing? Working notes. The origin of weeks. My friend, the writer Barbara Rosenthal, gave me a page-a-day diary last Christmas to encourage me to write. Not seeing words anymore, I looked for another source. I found it in the TV news, which accounts for the bulk of the material. I typed it up week by week, which accounts for the title. Spoke was written clairvoyantly. I saw the words in small groups on my forehead and wrote them down in a notebook. The large words were seen on the notebook page. I wrote it one summer, late at night, in bed, in my mother's home. This is from the most recent issue of However, on which I am an editor. However is a journal for poets and scholars interested in modernist innovative directions in women's poetry. These are what we call working notes from the poet Hannah Wiener. And in this poem, she calls what she is doing hysterical form. This is the poem, one of the poems that was published with those working notes. You can't see it, but she comments on it here and underlines form. We request that contributors write working notes, something like short, casual case histories of their own imaginative mental processes to accompany their poetry. Poetic line, as Kathleen Frazier states, is a primary defining place, the site of watchfulness where we discover how we hear ourselves take in the outside world and tell it back to ourselves. There are very few great poets who have not taken chance with the line, perceived it as a tool for reassembling language to a new order, one's own at that moment. For this reason, the frame of the page, the measure of the line, has provided for many contemporary women poets the difficult pleasure of reinventing the givens of poetry, imagining in visual structural terms core states of female social and psychological experience not yet adequately tracked, hesitancy, silencing or speechlessness, continuous disruption of time, illogical resistance, simultaneous perception, social marginality. The experiences Frazier lists as manifest in the line locate the juncture of kinds of subjectivity turned into kinds of aesthetic choices. Concern with formal aspects of writing, the complex relationship between syntax, multiple viewpoint, shifting narrative voices, layering of meaning, the arrangement of language on the page, are only a few elements of a poetics that, to speak very generally, was characteristically modernist. These concerns in themselves reflect a modernist discomfort with the relationship between subjectivity and representation, a discomfort quite different for female modernists than for male. Female modernist writers were often seen by contemporaries, such as Pound and Eliot, as receptacle-like muses rather than active agents. Thus, the kinds of subjectivity and poetics that many of these writers present are posed against dominant notions of what is naturally feminine by women who are already unnatural by virtue of writing. One of the traits that often distinguishes their work from that of experimenting male modernists, which there were a lot of, is a concern with gender constructions themselves as featured issues of importance to explore within and through the structure of the poem. Virginia Woolf and Dorothy Richardson, a contemporary of Woolf's and one of the first to experiment from the point of view of a woman's consciousness with the form of the novel, as well as many modernist poets, feature the dismantling of feminine essences and what Burke has called a critique of attention in their critical, poetic, and fictive writing. In fiction and poetry, this critique of attention can be witnessed by looking at the arrangements of language on the page. When form has been experienced as a constraint, it becomes itself a deliberate tool for making meanings. As with the demonstrations of the female hysteric's body, if we look undefensively at what may at first appear chaotic, visual cues remind us to attend to our own automatic habits of reading for content and plot, to reorient and read here for something else that may not be a story, though it is a narrative that tells. As Fraser suggests, while the unit of sense is still the sentence, the unit of our attention is the line, and our interest is captured or deflated by how that line is articulating its subject. What can an accurate skeletal picture reveal about the subject? Or if the subject is yet to be brought into focus, what learned prohibitions have women poets worked against to uncover and catch partial knowledge? What if the subject itself is resistance, vulnerability, seeming lack of will, the conditioned self-denial that creates uncertainty, unsteadiness in the world? Richardson, H.D., Mina Loy, Stein, Niedecker, Laura Writing Jackson, and other modernist innovating writers all share with Woolf in perpetually wishing, as she says in her 1929 essay, Women in Fiction, to alter the established values, to make serious what appears insignificant to a man and trivial what is to him important. In her critical essay, Women in the Arts, Richardson describes an inclusive awareness from which men, for good or ill, are exempt. In the introduction to her 13-volume epic novel, Pilgrimage, Richardson explains that in attempting to invent an alternative to the current masculine realism, she has developed a method that captures 100 faces of revelation by direct statement. On the page of the early 20th century British novel, the profile of Richardson's heretic line use was thought to be dull, obsessive, experimental in the worst sense of what feminist experiments could bring, and it was more rarely loved. This is a page from one of her novels called Honeycomb, and if you're closer, you can see how it's very oddly constructed on the page, and it goes on with lots of variations throughout the 13 volumes, like that, believe it or not. Okay. H.D. introduced the concept of the palimpsest, writing on top of other writing, memory on memory, which through time and benign or active neglect has been imperfectly erased, defaced, or lost. Stein introduced the concept of the continuous present. Emily Dickinson gave form to hesitation, breaking lines at the point where one Emily hesitates to speak another. Mina Loy and Laureen Niedecker condensed to a shorthand of bare bones, acute and shifting observation, laced with imagistic and ironic social critique. And Marion Moore plays constantly with grammatical authority and authorial presence, beginning a poem mid-thought, dismantling in the end of a poem a statement presented as an answer in the beginning. These and many other modernist experimenting women writers are usually viewed, as Burke has pointed out, as isolated cases, rather than as a group of women who, due to a convergence of historical circumstances, class positions, and their marginal relations to white male dominant discourses as both desired privileged objects and colonized subjects, found it necessary to question inherited notions of their proper places in their own writing and in their early 20th century British or US contexts. There is danger in being thought of as an isolated case, rather than as one of many women subverting the given forms and orderings of subjects in writing. One of the hazards in being thought of as an isolated case, and one which has occurred to most of the writers I've mentioned, is exclusion from the male literary canon. There is currently an even more alarming danger of double exclusion from the male and also from the forming canon of women's literature. A recent example of this is the deletion from the new Norton Anthology of Women Writers of Mina Loy, Laura Writing Jackson, Jane Bowles, Mary Butts, Laureen Niedecker, and the contemporary poet novelist Barbara Guest, among many others. The Norton Anthology is, of course, one of the most often used texts for the teaching of high school and college writing and literature throughout this country. The two highly respected feminist critic editors of this new edition have subtitled it The Tradition in English. This absence of work by experimental women writers is duplicated in other anthologies and journals in the US at a time when there is an overabundance, literally thousands, of literary magazines and journals, a time called by some a virtual renaissance in American poetry. As Marianne de Koven describes in her recent Women's Review of Books article, Gertrude's Granddaughters, the fact that one hardly ever sees the writers I will discuss here mentioned in print except by one another is particularly surprising given the widespread interest among feminist critics in French theory, which emphasizes precisely the kinds of formal dislocations these writers employ. One hears of the language poets, a current predominantly male American avant-garde. They occupy a margin that has become a recognized position in the American literary scene. As long as an experimental writer whose signature is female aligns herself with the language poets, she has a place on the literary map. The price she pays, a price familiar to all of us, is twofold. The question of gender will be erased and declared a non-issue, and at the same time, it is less likely than if her signature were male that she will become one of the stars, even in that tiny firmament. The sheer complication of the processes to be represented at the meta level forces Freud to resort to a language of similes. More terrible still, when she who is a tree is Daphne, begins to move her limbs to attend to her own nature. Working notes, Honor Johnson. At first I was struck because the dark spot in each wan repainting, which opens like a lock or porthole, reminds me of his mouth, and in that way, landscape is a portrait. When I think back over something, it isn't just a postage stamp. It has its own nips to give. I try to see the cornfields in which I grew up, but instead of a ribbon of vision, each part opens and fractures emotionally, the kind of thing that makes me want to flinch into my own shoulders. And the break of surface seems to happen at each point and deeper. I become very vulnerable, as if there were a story which I can only get my body part way into. The rest is barred, blackened, really never was. As for language, never was is part of vivacity and rhythm, seizing on new tones and fields, new hallucinations, like the paintings I do in my sleep, more a person lying than a place. These working notes from another issue of However echo descriptions of hysterical symptoms, and the echoes ricochet elsewhere throughout the work of experimentalist women writers. De Koven's sketch of what is at stake for women in understanding that their aesthetics is at the same time an inscription of a subjectivity, an agreement to or breaking of laws defining the proper behavior for a poem or a woman has ramifications. I watch the ramifications circulate. The difficulty of publishing. I watch student writing change when exposed to this tradition. The ways in which tradition can serve as precedent and permission to remind writers that they are not isolated cases. The anxiety that women present when they represent. The imagined and gendered place of that which is impossible to represent, to make rationally coherent. The roaming female womb. The dangerous female imagination embodied in the erotic act of a woman writing. The last paragraph of a review of However by a prominent male poet. I have yet to meet anyone who has been able to sit and read Gertrude Stein for more than an hour at a stretch. Kenneth Rexroth alone has had the balls to say so in print. Or to remain excited by HD after 20 pages or so. These seem the primary goddesses behind this sort of writing. A poem is not a dictionary. A poem is not a set of easy metaphysical speculations on the nature of grammar, guilt, or the primal flood. Let's not keep the trope flying. Let's strangle the little creature in his crib before he soils his pants and screws up our life. Needless to say, we still inherit the woman question debate. In the face of it, muteness, inability to speak, the talking cure for those who need to be given rules about how to tell their stories, the obvious balls of the poem should suffice to enforce, to strangle infantile feminine talk before it makes a mess of a perfectly clean page. I'm going to end by reading a poem, which is what you all have, called The Colors in the Story. This poem is about an actual event of separation that occurred and it is also about the severity of the separation and dislocation experienced in the urgency of writing about anything. It has a narrative thread that moves through the poem, but the narrator is not in one place or of one mind. Each section of the poem works like a spot to walk around. Each time you stop, there is a different view of the convergence of events, a different arrangement of sense, and a different sensory image that tells. Each section is a variation of the way that the story literally lines up, a new entry into the field of what has happened. Colors in the story. Someone said, drink water. Someone else opened a window saying, peel, the orange in a perfect spiral. Sometimes the egg was an explosive mining the socket of her gut, acid light, white of shell, washing her where hands can't enter. Water, water, and what comes after? The light of the story spoken after, biting into an orange sliver, after what burns is white again. There are two worlds. In one, she is in labor forever, submarine life. We all focus on her face and opening, animal watch, comings and goings, no daylight or darkness, the pressure of water kept off all around us. Time collapsed to its cuticle. In the other book, she speaks to her zero and embraces the other one. She says, let your skin part without pulling off mine. Let lips part. You are a sliver dissolving on my tongue, a crescent slipping the horizon. You're what's left of our suction. It was called summer, yet she felt no gravity in the middle. That word, the weather, came up fever. Glaze on burnished metal sky, glass sun on redwoods, morning unstoppable. In the mirror, her legs turned to marble, succulent and stark as the surrounding magnolia flesh in all stages of bloom. Without training, she knew laser surgery, to cut with fine light, to bond with heat, a steady hand threaded invisibly to an unblinking eye. The absence before earthquakes, no clatter of birds, no clutter at the node of the gut, three gestures so quick that the attendants miss the execution, a sumi painting, severance of space by line, arc of iris cleaves, sight of pistil pulls our glance, stem to leaf, pull of perfect fits, no longer perfect, beheading that heals. If a bird is trapped in the house, what you have to do. After what burns is white again, she rinses her hands of the colors in the story. Water, water, and what comes after is left as the submarine surfaces. With those white fingers, she candles the orange, holding it up to the flame, saying, veins, arteries, cartilage. Someone else saying, pockets of juice, dark, tight. She fits one swollen section to another, twin to twin, tiny corpuscles shining, saying and fitting to make her body return. With what is said, she places her voice on the table. Thank you.
This is the last paper, 20 minutes, and then we'll have discussion.
Also, I'm going to be showing some slides. Let's
see. Yeah, need
here, you can put it on this box.
They're going to be quite small, but you can follow the papers without the slides.
Okay.
Right. Okay. I will start. Nothing. Keep going. Okay. It doesn't. Shut it off, and I'll tell you when to turn it on.
Okay. There's perhaps a little break in the continuity. My paper